We will all be in the general session back next door. There will be no more breakouts. It's the only one for the day. This morning, we're pleased to have with us Janetta Williams. She's the assistant professor of psychology at St. Edward's University in Austin. Ms. Williams was the, prior to that position, she was the program assistant for the Texas Association of Secondary School Principals in Austin. She acquired her PhD in educational psychology from the University of Texas at Austin, where she specialized in human development and education. Ms. Williams is a former trustee on the Board of Trustees for the Austin-Travis County Mental Health Mental Retardation Center, and congratulations, she is the most recent recipient of the Distinguished Teaching Award at St. Edward's University. Please welcome Janetta Williams.
All right. Can you hear me in the back? Good. All right. Well, thank you very much for the introduction. Wanted to start out this morning by saying thank you for allowing me to speak with you today. I've never been to Odessa before. I drove in from Austin yesterday, and so I saw my first oil rig pumping. That was the first time I ever saw that, so that was quite a treat. Quite a treat for me. And I wanted to also thank two of my colleagues who aren't going to be presenting here today, but we've been splitting all of the presentations across Texas. So I was able to present, of course, here in Amarillo and in Tyler, Texas last fall. My colleagues are also in the Department of Psychology at St. Edward's University, Dr. Sarah Villanueva Dixon, and her background area is in developmental psychology. She also has five children, so she has the information on both sides. My other colleague is Dr. Russell Frohart. His area of expertise is in behavioral neuroscience. So when I have brain questions, that kind of thing, then he's the go-to person. So I've borrowed heavily from them, and we've worked together. Ryan Turner is an adjunct faculty at St. Edward's University, so I'm fortunate to see him in that venue as well. So our topic for today is on adolescent decision-making behavior, and I was eavesdropping a little bit as some of our judges were coming in this morning, thinking that what were you thinking is a common question that you may be asking juveniles in your courtrooms. So we thought this was an appropriate title for our presentation. Let me start off by asking, how many of you sometimes feel like you're the vice principal of your local high school while you're in your courtroom? The disciplinarian, yes? Find yourself wondering, if adolescents had half a brain at all, why are they making some of the decisions and engaging in some of the behaviors that they are engaging in? So this question of what were you thinking is a rhetorical question, but for today, this is something that we're going to actually address. Oh, good. This is working. I'm sure that you're much more familiar with this court case, fairly recent, Supreme Court decision, Roper v. Simmons, than I am, but the gist of the decision was that it was deemed unconstitutional to impose capital punishment, even in death penalty states, for juveniles, for crimes committed prior to the age of 18. And the argument was that juveniles, their thinking is qualitatively different than that of adults. So one of the questions that we're faced with is, in what ways are adolescents' decision-making behavior, their thinking, similar to adults, and in which ways are they qualitatively different? And we're seeing that this is having some important consequences at the Supreme Court level, but certainly this is going to be an issue trickling down through all of the court systems. So my first question to you, and feel free to shout out, I'm going to write some up here on our flip chart, is why do you think adolescents make the decisions that they do? Less experience, okay. Thank you very much. I'm sorry?
Separate species.
Separate species, okay. Peer pressure, okay. More impulse driven. Anything else we want to put up here? Good decisions and poor decisions, but what might affect their decision making?
Well, their parents.
Parents, okay. I'm sorry, I heard over here. More. Certainly. Okay.
Fantasy.
These kind of go hand in hand, right? The media and the fantasy. Anything else we'd like to put up? These are really good, so I don't even have to present. I can just go home now. You've got all the answers already. Let's keep this list in mind. I'm going to go through a little scenario, and let's see if this list is still on target as we go through the next few minutes. This example comes from Ryan. This is not from my previous experience. This is the Sodom and Gomorrah party barn. So here's the scenario. Jimmy is a sophomore at the local high school, and his parents are out of town for the weekend. Perhaps his parents are judges, and they're at a judge's train. He decides to have a handful of friends over Friday night. Jimmy's older friend, Jane, there's always a Jane, offers to buy a case of beer for the party. And she tells some of her friends about the party as well. 50 people end up in the barn drinking. The cops come, cite Jimmy and company, and now they're in your court. So what kind of charges might this scenario bring in your courtrooms? Possession? Consumption and possession? Okay. Disturbing the peace? Making alcohol available, tobacco. I see where you're going with this. You had the smile, tobacco. Paraphernalia. Other activities, perhaps, that they should probably not be engaged in the party barn. So, all right, Jimmy started off, right, just wanted to have a few friends over, but ends up in a lot of trouble. So some of the questions that we would like to address today are, why did Jimmy make such bad decisions? Why didn't he anticipate getting into trouble? Or did he anticipate it and chose to engage in these behaviors anyway? And why didn't he turn away the friends of friends? So rather than having the handful of friends over, why didn't he turn the additional people away? First, let's start out with some of the general risk factors that can contribute to adolescent decision-making behavior. We've just discussed what could go wrong with Jimmy, but let's look at why these things can go wrong. And of course, every adolescent is different, but these are some general risk factors. So if an individual has multiple risk factors, they might be looking at being in some serious trouble. Put all these up here. So we have four categories of risk factors: psychological, which refer to the individual; familial; social; and then context or environment. Let's start off with psychological. Some of the personality characteristics that can lead an individual to more risky decision-making behavior include impulsivity. So this lack of impulse control is exactly on. Inattentiveness and also a history of anger can lead a teen to making decisions, poor decisions, but engaging in behaviors perhaps before thinking through these consequences. A history of mental illness. It doesn't mean that every teen their highs and lows, being moody, these kinds of things indicate mental illness. But if a history of mental illness is present, such as depression or anxiety disorders or substance abuse disorders, can make one more at risk of making poor decisions. A history of abuse, psychological abuse, or neglect. So perhaps it's a combination of family and psychological factors that's influencing their behavior. Does that make sense? Questions? Okay. What about families? We said parents can certainly influence adolescents, their upbringing, their parenting styles. One is a lack of support. Not only financial support and psychological support, but emotional support as well. If that lack of connection, that lack of an emotional bond between parent and teen can lead them to try to seek connections and feelings of acceptance and belonging with others, and the group to which they seek that belonging may not be the most advantageous. In terms of parenting and disciplinary styles, overly permissive parents on the one hand and neglectful parents, that kind of style can be problematic because the teen is left to his or her own devices to kind of figure out what's right or wrong. On the other end, parents that have a more conflicting relationship, the very strict disciplinarian, without very much discussion, can also be problematic. In your courtrooms, do you tend to see one of these parenting types more frequently? Like the overboard disciplinarian, there's too many rules so they rebel, or the other side, the more permissive, okay, kind of anything goes parenting?
Okay.
Uninvolved parents, kind of the... Right, so maybe not a choice of I'm choosing to let my kids do whatever because I think that's best, but just having no knowledge, right, of what your child is into. Choosing to be the kid's friend rather than their parent. So we see those two extremes as related to having higher risk. From when I've presented across Texas, what I've found is that most of the judges have reported that it's more of the permissive, anything goes parenting that can be more problematic. Distant and hostile parenting. So one of the issues here is that the teen feels that they cannot communicate what's kind of going on or problematic in their lives with their caregivers. Lack of values, religious beliefs, traditions, and moral values that provide a moral framework for teens to make decisions. So not having friends over on Friday night, the reason behind that more than just because I said so, right? But thinking about what some of the consequences, moral consequences, may be. Low SES, which is socioeconomic status, so fewer economic resources to devote to adolescents. In terms of the structure of the family, with single parent versus a two-parent household or a two-caregiver household or a blended family, the issue here is really supervision, which we've alluded to already. It's not just having, just living with your mom per se that's problematic. It's how many adults are supervising and keeping track of your behaviors. And if there are multiple caregivers in a blended family, are the discipline strategies and the parenting styles consistent? So do you have one parent that always says no when you want to go stay out past your curfew, and another that says, oh, yes, that's fine with me? So that type of not being on the same page in terms of discipline can be problematic as well. For social factors, we're talking about a lack of attachment to school, religious institutions, other groups to which positive learning, positive engagement, and social support can take place. So if those are lacking, adolescents may seek that type of support with teens that may be involved in delinquent activities. So again, it's not just the gang mentality that's problematic per se. It's what that type of group can provide, right? A sense of belonging, a sense of acceptance, a set of rules and structure. But the problems come in because they may be involved in lots of delinquent activities. So the adolescent who joins the gang or starts to affiliate with these types of groups may fall into those activities as well. The last one, context, has to do with environmental factors. Certainly families and schools and religious institutions, extracurricular activities and organizations are part of one's context as well, but we can also add in community factors here. Teens with too much time on their hands, right? What do they say about idle hands? Right. They're going to find something to do to fill their time. And so one way to reduce risk is to fill up a teen's time with pro-social activities. Some of the community-level risk factors, one is a lack of resources in the community. These can be educational resources, certainly financial resources, but also community-level centers, rec centers, places where teens can be safe, and engage in positive activities and learning. High unemployment, so poverty, is certainly a risk factor for delinquency. A lack of law enforcement or a perception that crimes are not punished, individuals committing those crimes won't be prosecuted. The idea here is there a sense that I can kind of do what I want and get away with it? Even if that's not true, this perception. If there is a lot of drug activity and crimes in the community, that can take on a kind of social norm. This is what normally occurs in a community, so teens might follow along with the status quo. Questions on these so far? Good. All right. Well, those were some of the general risk factors. So, of course, if we've flip those to the other side of the continuum, we can look at some of the protective factors. Fostering positive mental health. Certainly, individual adolescents may have a history of mental illness. Aside from that, an absence of depressive symptoms fosters resiliency. Fostering high self-esteem, a sense of self-worth. And I'd like to also add a sense of self-worth that is diverse. So your self-worth isn't wrapped up in just one area. You don't want to get all of your self-esteem eggs, so to speak, from the same basket. So if a teen is struggling a little bit with academics, then perhaps they're still very talented in, let's say, in music, for example, or other extracurricular activities, or athletics, or they're a leader in their church and do volunteer work. So there's a lot of different areas for them to succeed. High academic achievement. Having a goal in mind, such as I want to go to college, or professional or technical school, I want to get a certain scholarship, so I need to keep my grades up, I want to do well so that I can keep being the star athlete on my team. These kinds of things help keep them on track for avoiding poor decisions. Connectedness with school. It doesn't always have to be academics. If you have a teenager who is struggling, kind of an average, maybe a little bit below average student, it doesn't mean necessarily that they're going to be at risk for making poor decisions or being engaged in risky activities. If they have a wide variety of diverse areas, diverse interests for them to still feel connected to school. Close and nurturing family relationships. Do you believe that your caregivers, perhaps older siblings, that they are your allies, they are your advocates, also your confidants? So you can ask them, and based on your experience, what do you think I should do? So someone that they feel they can confide in and talk about some difficult issues that occur during adolescence. And, of course, involvement in activities, including religious institutions, community groups, and school groups. We're often surprised, I think, at the juveniles who seem to be very high-achieving students, perhaps a top athlete, not the kind of kid you would think would fall into delinquency. How often do you see those individuals in your courtrooms? From time to time? Do you see? And that's the surprise, right? Like, with the absence of a lot of these risk factors, why are you here, right, specifically? What got you here? So again, these are general risk factors, but there may be individual circumstances that could lead an individual to engage in risky behaviors aside from these. So I think that's always surprising. In my courses, so I mainly teach students in their first year or in their fourth year of college, and I see a huge difference between the freshmen and in the seniors. And some of the freshmen, they share in the classes, oh, I'm going to tell you what I used to do in high school. And it's wonderful students, you know, a little bit shy, always engaged in their coursework, and they have some of the wildest stories of things they engaged in high school that surprise me. So it's not always who you would expect, and that may be the most troubling. So we've looked at some of the general risk factors and protective factors, but now let's look at some of the changes that occur during adolescence, which may help us to understand, you know, given all of those protective factors, why is this kid getting into trouble? And getting into trouble perhaps repeatedly, right? You love the repeat offender. So we'd like to look at biological, cognitive, and social cognitive changes. Biological changes here primarily are changes in the brain and the body. Cognitive changes, so changes in regards to thinking, so learning, memory, problem solving. And social cognitive changes, social cognitive meaning thinking about yourself in terms of relationships with others. So let's start out with the biological changes. I'm glad that actually no one shouted this out, but it would have been fun actually if you did. But one explanation that I see a lot for why teens do what they do is, well, they've got out of control hormones, as if, you know, the hormones have taken over and they have no control or say so over what they're doing. And there are hormonal changes that occur that are tied to puberty, but this teens are out of control because of their raging hormones is actually a little bit more myth than it is reality. The changes associated with puberty, including physical growth and secondary sex characteristics, often are changes due in appearance. So things like development of breasts, deepening of the voice, facial hair among men, and of course, growing taller. Puberty, through these hormonal changes, can have direct and indirect effects on adolescent development. So let's look at some of the direct influences first. I'm not going to go through all of them, but just a few that have some significant consequences, significant influences on development. One is that in puberty, and by the way, by puberty, what I'm referring to here, you know, how do you know when puberty is occurring? For females, usually that's indicated by age at first menarche, at first period. In the United States, this is about what age, on average, you think, for girls, when puberty starts? 12? Yes, so right, around 12, 12 and a half. About 80 years ago, 70, 80 years ago, in the U.S., this was closer to about 17 and a half. So the age has decreased quite a bit in the past century. So, you know, 80 years ago, having young girls beginning puberty at age 9 or 10 would be very rare, barring some type of disorder. But today, it's much more common. So we do want to keep that in mind. It's been leveling off since the mid-60s to about 12, 12 and a half. I'm not sure how low, of course, it's going to go. But just by comparison, in other developing countries, it's still around 17. So it's interesting how the age at when puberty onset occurs is getting a bit younger and younger, which may explain some of the issues that younger and younger girls are having. One of the direct effects is that hormones tend to delay sleep patterns. There's a sleep pattern shift compared to earlier childhood. So the issue is, when are adolescents most awake, and what impact does this have on their behavior? So there's a shift from being quite awake in early morning to later morning. What time does school begin, typically? 8 o'clock? Around 8 o'clock? When I was in high school, we had homeroom, I think, at 7:30. And first period around 8 o'clock or 8:30. That is not, at least according to research, when most teens are awake. It usually is later morning. So for any of you who've been in schools or been trying to wake up that teenager to get on their bus or to get to school by 8 o'clock and it's problematic, this may be one reason why. When I was in high school, I know that there was a lot of students who missed their first or second periods of school and may, you know, give that excuse, I don't want to get up. Well, there's some truth to that, And also, late at night, they're feeling awake to a later portion of the night, midnight to 1 a.m. So what time does school end, typically? About 3, 3:30? So what are they doing between 3:30 and midnight or 1 a.m.? So if we're just talking about time, that's a lot of time to potentially get into trouble. So how much of that time can we fill with more pro-social activities? So this is a more of a direct influence. How about indirect influences, right? So not just how changes in puberty directly impact development, but here we're talking about reactions to pubertal development, primarily in appearance. Adolescents may engage in distancing behaviors, wanting to be separating themselves from their parents, wanting to have their own room, making sure that parents don't go into their bedroom when they're not there. There's privacy issues. I always enjoy this. I have a niece who's 17, and whenever she is, she's changing clothes in front of my mom or her mom, she's very private about it. I don't want you to see. And they always say, we've seen all of this before. I don't know if you don't recall all of this, but we've actually seen you nude before. But the sense of, oh, I have something you haven't seen before. So not a sense of shame, but just wanting to keep that a private sense of distancing. Isolating themselves in their room, engaging with petty arguments about privacy with their parents. Speaking of puberty, it's important to consider not only when puberty begins, which is the timing of puberty, but also the tempo, right? The speed at which development occurs. If you're an individual who matures early, right, kind of the early bloomer, you could finish, right, with puberty early as well, or it might take several years. But let's consider the timing issue in terms of boys and girls who mature early. And are there different outcomes related to this for boys and girls? For boys who mature early, there can be some benefits. Positive self-views, getting taller, getting stronger, seeming more manly, so to speak, maybe related to popularity, being more athletic. With our contact sports today, it seems like the bigger, the stronger, the better. So there may be actually some pressure to build that up even more. However, boys who mature early, research shows, may be more likely to engage in delinquent activities. One example of this with the growth of facial hair is the belief that maybe a fake ID may be believed, right? So not the baby-faced boy who's going to try to buy a beer, but the boy who's got a little beard going on may think, I can go purchase beer for my friends. What about girls? What do you think? Positive outcomes if you mature early, or a higher risk of delinquency? You think the opposite? You think the opposite from the boys? Let's check it out. Some opposite patterns. One is that self-views tend to be more negative. And often these are tied to changes in the body due to secondary sex characteristics. One of the key changes for girls is a change in the relationship or ratio between lean body mass and fat. And during puberty, the ratio of fat goes up, proportion of fat goes up. And girls may be very self-conscious about this, that my body doesn't look right in comparison with other girls. I feel fat. So there can be a lot of pressures and feelings of being self-conscious about your appearance. However, some of these changes can bring on increased interaction with older peers. So girls who are beginning to develop may be noticed by older peers, particularly boys. So that's kind of a problematic duo. Not really feeling comfortable in your own skin, feeling kind of negative about your own body, but someone else who's older, who may be very attractive to you, takes notice, right? So girls who mature early, young girls, running with an older crowd, with older peers, delinquent behaviors are much more likely. So in the research literature, we see, this is correlational, of course, but we see girls who mature early having a higher risk of drug activity, unplanned pregnancies, sexually transmitted diseases, experimentation with drugs and alcohol, and academic difficulties. All right. Questions here? Yes, sir. Yeah, I think that's an excellent question, and I do think there's a lot of truth to that. My question was, do you see that more of parents kind of promoting that, or media promoting that, or both? Maybe media affecting parents and feeling pressure to so kind of where is that coming from? This they call it sexualization of younger girls. So you see, clothing, like you're saying, for girls 6-7 years of age that model adult clothing patterns, or we could say trampy, right, clothing styles at any age, right? Yeah, I think. Right, so that's. Yeah, so I think, the young girls seeing a lot of the advertising, seeing their friends saying, I really, really want this, and pressuring, parents, I really, really want this. They go to the mall or go to the shopping center and say, this is what everybody's wearing. And parents kind of falling, I don't say falling victim to it, but saying, well, okay, you can have these things.
Doing this.
Yeah, so do you think it's kind of a, I don't want my child to be ostracized, or maybe just keeping up with the Joneses kind of thing?
And I think it goes the whole socioeconomic spectrum from low income to high.
Absolutely. The pressures are kind of across the board. So I think that's a really tough question. What the other side of it I was thinking about with parents maybe pressuring kids to grow up too fast is it can be helpful to have kids involved in extracurricular activities, of course, right? We've talked about eating up their time. But sometimes parents push their kids to do too much and getting rid of some of the free play time that they need. So having them involved in 5 or 6 different sports and planning on, well, you've got to do this for and be the best so that you can get a scholarship. And you see this with even younger and younger kids, pressure on, you know, playing soccer, this kind of thing, very, very young. So I think a little bit of that can be going on as well. There's a tension there with younger adolescents, right? So we're thinking, you know, 12, 13 years of age, have them have some free time to kind of develop their interests and free play, but are they going to get into trouble? So I think there's kind of a tension there as well. Yes, sir? So the language, how they interact, is almost like I'm mimicking. Well, first, I guess the good side is that it may be Hannah Montana because there's worse things on television to be mimicking than that. But you're right. Kind of looking for what's cool, how I should behave, how should I look, and looking for people in the media rather than people in their own lives to role model, which can be problematic depending on who they are role modeling after. Thank you. Thank you for sharing there. Yeah, and I personally, I'm not a big fan of high-stakes testing. I'm sorry if you're a fan. I'm not a fan. Increased pressures on performance, right? You have to have this A or you can forget going to college or whatever. This is kind of a hangover from childhood, but it's this, what is it called? A contingent self-esteem. So you're a good person and worthwhile of admiration, my love and respect for you as a child, and there's something you have to do. It's this conditional regard rather than unconditional love and respect. And certainly kids internalize that when they're young in adolescence. And unfortunately, adults can do this as well. So if you're feeling pretty good about yourselves and they talk to one of your parents and they bring up one of your flaws, you can still get hung up on that kind of issue. But you're right, these demands that many parents make, thinking that they're looking out for the best interests of their child, can actually be internalized as something more negative. If I get a B, I'm a failure, right? Or I'm not a good person, I'm not very smart. Yes, ma'am. Thank you. You're right. It's not just parents, but it's a climate of what is important, and what's important is a number on this one test. There couldn't be more high stakes for a kid that age. So certainly seeing things like anxiety, sleeplessness, and worries, and it unfortunately doesn't go away with sixth grade, unfortunately. Thank you. Some of the cognitive changes that we see, generally speaking, are in the capacity and complexity of thought, and perspective-taking abilities take off. Now, certainly, again, this is going to differ at an individual level. So, I have students who are 22, 23, and they're still working on this stuff, right? But I'm sure that you know individuals who are 13 or 14 and very adult-like in their reasoning and problem-solving. So there's a pretty wide variety here. But these are some of the changes that generally occur during adolescence. All right. The use of an understanding of abstract concepts, things like fairness, things like character. If you're trying to tell a six-year-old, you should share your toys with your brother or sister because that's what someone with good character does. That has no meaning, right? No meaning at all. But things like justice, things like sexism, they begin to understand in adolescence. This use of deductive reasoning, these if-then types of statements, they can start thinking through hypothetical competing scenarios. So with Jimmy, if I tell Jane not to invite those other friends over, what could happen? If Jane buys beer, what could happen? All right, can think through all of the consequences for these scenarios. Thinking about their own thinking, right? Thinking back about what you're thinking about, your thought processes. Metacognition, they can monitor their own thinking. So it seems kind of like an abstract thing, but am I making a good decision right now? They can actually think about their thought processes. Thinking also becomes much more relative. There's no more black and white thinking, but more shades of gray. So this is generally a good thing, right, because thinking becomes more complex. But if you're a parent, this can be a double-edged sword, because now an adolescent may be able to argue back about the fairness of curfews rather than 11 o'clock, you have to be home because I said so. They can start coming up with counter reasons why that may not be fair, right? So they become much better in arguments. So I could say that's kind of a double-edged sword there. This is primarily due to development in the brain. So if we're using a computer metaphor, the capacity, so the amount, and efficiency or speed of processing increases during adolescence. So we see areas of the brain further developing from childhood, ripening, so to speak. And so this explains why we see perspective-taking abilities take off. Some cognitive changes that are actually paradoxical. In early adolescence, the limbic system of the brain, which includes some kind of emotional processing centers, deep cortical structures, come online. So early adolescence, limbic system really starting to take off. The limbic system is related to a desire to seek novelty, reward, thrill-seeking, diverse sensations, kind of the, I want to try this just to see how it feels or what it's like, motivation. So that's an early adolescence. However, it's not until later adolescence when the prefrontal cortex, which is the very front portion of the brain, that's the CEO or executive of the brain, is developing. So that fosters planning and thinking through consequences. What is problematic here, right? You can see early adolescence, thrill-seeking comes on board. It's not until later adolescence the ability to think through what if I do engage in these behaviors takes place. So the seeking of thrills and rewards occurs before the ability to think through possible consequences has really taken off. This may be one explanation why. This seems like a smart kid. Why do they think playing chicken in traffic is a good idea? Right? Why do they want to do something that just doesn't make sense? Right? So both of these systems may be taking place. So this is just a little graph here. And do I have a laser? Ooh, very nice. And we see the blue is gray matter, so we think the good thinking parts of the brain. This is age 5, and this is age 20. So we see the areas in blue, right? This is percentage of gray matter. So when we get adolescence, mid-adolescence, we see there's more and more gray matter, more and more structures coming online. But this is the age 20 or so. So we're thinking 13, 14-year-olds, this is all still developing. Right? This is also why I believe we take risky behavior so seriously, because of the consequences on brain development. So although they may be wanting to try drugs and alcohol to see what it feels like in an early age, we certainly could see long-term damage later on. What about social cognitive changes? Adolescents spend more time thinking about interpersonal relationships, themselves in interpersonal relationships. They try out new social identities, challenge social norms and beliefs. So trying to find out who you are, changing clothing, manners of speaking, hairstyles, things like that, that's normal to occur. That you could see pretty drastic changes. Now, who are they looking for kind of a cue to what's cool or what's new to try? It might be Hannah Montana, right? Or someone else. But this is kind of a general thing to occur. This also, I think, explains why teens eat up so many minutes on their cell phones, right? Texting and talking on the phone by replaying the minutiae of their interpersonal relationships, right? It almost sounds like a sporting event. If you listen to teens sometimes on the phone, they'll give you the play-by-play of what he said and then she said and then what I said, as if you're watching a baseball event. Adolescents do begin to understand some very complex social relationships and social conventions. So things like religion, politics, the economy, so kind of these really broad social structures. However, the decisions to engage in risky behaviors are often more connected to how does this affect me, personal costs, than society. So it would be rare to hear a teen say, well, I'm not going to vandalize with my peers because of the potential costs of cleanup to my community, right? It's more personal, right? I might get caught or I might get busted. I might get grounded. Let's look at some specific ways in which adolescent thinking is quite different from adults. That is, it's different from is quite unique. One is called the imaginary audience. This is everybody will notice. Adolescents may feel that their behavior and their appearance is on spotlight. So if they don't have that name brand shirt that everyone else is wearing, or if they haven't seen that movie that everyone else has seen, or that video game that everyone else has played, that everybody will notice, right? As if there's a spotlight following them around. Everyone's going to notice that I have this pimple on my face. We know it's an imaginary belief, and not everybody will notice, but those consequences, those dire consequences for not having that name brand shirt may feel very real to them. Another development is egocentric thinking. This is thinking that is very self-focused. And I don't mean it here like being selfish, like everything has to be for me, but a lot of their thinking is eaten up by thinking about themselves. How do I look? How do I think I look? How do I think others think I look? What did I say? Did it seem strange? And this may be what they're talking about on their cell phones and texting. I'm not sure, right? But there's a lot of minutes being eaten up talking about themselves. So this idea of being in the spotlight, spending a lot of time thinking about themselves and in relationships to other people. And the last is the personal fable. It won't happen to me. So adolescents can be quite aware of the negative consequences for their behavior at kind of a general level, right? When some teens drink and drive, some of them will have accidents, right, or negative things occur, but they won't think it would actually happen to them, as if their experiences are unique. This can lead to a sense of invulnerability, right, that I can engage in anything and something negative won't happen. Even if someone close to me, a parent or an older sibling, says, hey, this could really happen to you, there still might be a disconnect. This is one explanation given why if you show in high school, you bring everyone into the auditorium and you have an assembly and you just talk about drinking and driving, for example, how that's not as effective as when they do the mock accidents. Have you seen these, the mock accidents? So they have someone act the driver and actually have bodies and things like that, because it makes it feel real to them. This is what it actually could feel like if it happened to you. Can you think of other examples of that? Right? I hear parents say, I told my kid what happened to me when I was young, and they don't believe me or it didn't have any effect on them. But how to make something real without them actually having to experience it? Can you think of any other examples? To prevent, let's see, to have them believe that something negative could actually happen to them. Drawn blanks. It's early. I was thinking this may be one reason why teen court may be more effective. So having a peer, you know, someone that they look up to, same age, that they can relate to, you know, talk about something that happened to them that was negative or potential consequences, rather than some a star or someone much older that they can't really feel like they can relate to. So in comparing adolescents and adults, their ability, I'll highlight the word ability here, their ability to plan and consider consequences, this if-then thinking, doesn't differ too much from adults. So this means you could sit an adolescent down and say, hey, if you decided to have friends over, more people come than you planned on, and someone brings beer, can you think of all the consequences that might occur? They could likely sit there and do it. The difference comes in the impact of social cost to them personally. Adolescents weight that much more heavily than adults, right? So whereas adults would say, wow, if the cops come and I get in trouble, that's a huge cost compared to just telling a few people they can't come to the party. For adolescents, that may be weighted the same, right? If I have to tell all the popular kids they can't come to the party versus I might get busted, I'll risk it, right? At least they'll think I'm cool, right? So although we might see that as very irrational, the difference is not their ability to make decisions, it's weighing the impact of the social cost. So this no or less fear of consequences, that is dead on. So now we've got some ways to address what Jimmy has done, why he made such poor decisions. Now, in this scenario, I didn't give a lot of background for Jimmy's home life or parenting. Maybe he has permissive parents, right? Said, hey, we're out of town. You do whatever you want, as long as the house is clean. I didn't give a lot of information about that. But just looking at some of the ways in which thinkings differ, why didn't he anticipate getting into trouble? We can talk about his inability to project very far into the future, still developing this if-then thinking, this personal fable. We won't get busted, right? We're pretty quiet. No one will find out. Why didn't he turn away the friends of friends? Social pressures can be very great. It can be hard for us as adults to understand, hey, friend, you know, we say friends come and go. Our true friend wouldn't get you into trouble. But, right, that social rejection or lack of acceptance that occur can feel very real to them. That's right. The older girl gave him attention. And he may have had an eye on her for a while. I like the details we're adding to the story. Jane is a troublemaker, a troubled youth. You would have had the party?
There you go.
All right. That's why I thought he'd have less people. But all right. So how can we put this information to use? As we've done these presentations across Texas, and in talking with Ryan, we try to figure out, based on what we've learned here, what we talked about, how can that connect to what you could actually do in your courtrooms? So a lot of these examples have come from the presentations that we've done prior. So, and connecting this to chapter 45 in your Code for Criminal Procedure. One is taking advantage of the family being in court. Right? So being a neglectful or permissive parent in terms of their preferred parenting style may be okay for them, but it's not working out, right, if their children are falling into trouble. So we can put pressure on parents to make sure that their kids are staying out of trouble. Let's see, failure to pay fine, contempt, and for juveniles, removing driving privileges. Right? When you can have the keys to the car, it used to be primarily for boys, but I think now it's for boys and girls. Taking away the keys can be a big social consequence. Let's see, where was I? In Amarillo, I had one judge who said, well, it had taken away that cell phone. Right? If they want to do the play-by-play, she'd say, hey, we're taking that cell phone away. And she said, the kid didn't know we couldn't do that, but we did it anyway. Suspension of sentence and deferral of final disposition. The judge may require a defendant to submit to testing for drugs and alcohol. So this could be, right, substance abuse issues, psychosocial assessment. Is there an underlying psychological disorder? Is there depression, anxiety, schizophrenia? And compliance with any other reasonable condition. So here, making connections between the offense and condition, keeping protective factors in mind. So if we had a juvenile who engaged in graffiti, vandalism, what might be a good consequence that's related to protective factors we talked about today for that? All right, clean it up. Yeah, clean it up. So there's a direct connection between what you did and how much time you're going to have to spend. Other volunteer efforts, right? So you're required to complete this many volunteer hours. Dismissal of misdemeanor charge on completion of a teen court program. This is taking advantage of the power of social influence, the not-so-imaginary audience. So this is also tying in the social aspect, the relatability aspect, and who's typically members of teen courts? Who are usually in the teen courts? Who kind of run it? In school. So, you know, is it, you know, who volunteers to run the court, or is it previous offenders that take part in this, run the programs in schools? This is one place that perhaps prior offenders could take part in, right? So it's not just, hey, I'm a teen who's never been down that road before, but maybe.
We rotate them back through.
Oh, okay, good.
They come back and serve as juror, and they have to attend two more teen courts.
It's been very successful. You said it was very successful. Funding is a big issue behind a lot of these. Failure to attend school proceeding and offenses committed by juveniles. Several types of activities that fall under protective factors for future success, and certainly funding is going to influence how many of these are used. So when we had our presentation in Austin, there were different resources available than when I was in Tyler. But self-improvement counseling, self-esteem and leadership training. So a kid who is struggling to fit in and for belonging, put them in charge of something. Make them a leader. Job skills training, violence avoidance training, parental involvement, so maybe more parenting skills classes, and engaging in community service. Back in Austin, our city is considering, is going to have to do some budget cuts, and it's getting community feedback about some possibilities, what things could be cut or charging fees for different things. And one of the programs that is an option is a youth employment program. And they're considering cutting it, I believe, in half or so. And it serves about 750 to 900 adolescents. So one of my co-presenters, colleagues, wrote a letter and participated in these community events. And the letter that she wrote into the newspaper was very interesting. I should have brought it because she said, you know, it's very ironic that right now I'm participating, doing these presentations on adolescent decision making, things that can keep teens out of trouble. And at the same time, my own city is talking about, right on the chopping block, a program that's going to give takeaway jobs and add a lot more free time to kids who are already at risk. I'm sure that's not just in Austin that that issue is occurring, but that was just one example. The authority to employ juvenile case managers. How many of you have used juvenile case managers in your courts, have this available? Can you talk a little bit about what that experience has been like?
Mm-hmm. Getting them to court, they've been truant because they move around, they don't get reporting addresses, and the schools are way behind on keeping up. So making that extra effort to try to at least get them into the court also.
So definitely help facilitating the process in both your examples. Good. Any other individuals you've used the juvenile case managers? Well, this sounds like I didn't actually know about this program until we had our presentation back in Austin, and I thought, I didn't know if it was just in Austin or if there was other areas, but we found that it's been used just by a small number of courts, a smaller number, but it sounds like a wonderful program. And the funding, right, if you have funding available. Things we've talked to today, right, teens are very responsive to praise and positive feedback, right? So if their thinking is often about themselves, take advantage, praise them, right? They like that. One example that a judge offered was having letters of support and praise. I think this was primarily by teachers and coaches or directors, advisors of student organizations in high school that were read in court. So praising them for the positive behaviors that they're engaged in. Of course, the earlier, the better. So community support and protective factors. You know, if it seems difficult to reach teens sometimes in high school, perhaps targeting them earlier in middle school before a lot of these behaviors have occurred can be more effective. Unfortunately, some of the behaviors engaging in activities such as experimenting with drugs and alcohol, sexual practices, is occurring earlier and earlier. So, you know, 20 years ago, we thought, well, we don't have to talk about this stuff with middle schoolers. And unfortunately, today, we do. In terms of violence, physical violence, again, You know, 20, 30 years ago, we might have thought this is primarily with boys, but we're seeing much higher numbers of girls engaged in physical aggression on top of other types of aggression as well. So in terms of risky behavior, we're seeing younger and both boys and girls engaged in some of these activities. And working with existing community support programs and encouraging initiatives that propose additional protective factors for adolescents. So again, there's a lot of nonprofits out there and private foundations, private organizations that might have the resources that we don't have, that varies from community to community, but taking advantage of those, having someone like the juvenile case manager seek out and get information about these types of programs. That's all I had for you this morning, but if you have other programs or ideas that you'd like to share, I've got my pen handy, and I will write them down and share them as I go back, or questions. So now when we say, what were you thinking? We'll still want the adolescents to answer that question, but we have some insights of maybe why were you thinking what you were thinking, or why didn't you anticipate these other these possible outcomes? Thank you again for meeting with me this morning bright and early. Our coffee might be running out, but just a reminder that the general session is going to be next door as well. He asked me to remind you. And good luck with everything. And if you have questions, you can always contact Mark or Ryan Turner to get a hold of any of our presenters. Thank you very much. Thanks to you. Yes, sir. Turn us off.